I think we have students from Augusta High School. Would they please stand? It's good seeing you. You may be seated. And we have students from Lakeshore Technical College. Would they stand? Good seeing you. You may be seated. The students are here with us with a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Supreme Court. It is called Court with Class. Students are invited to join us for an oral argument. They are sent copies of the briefs on the case that they are about to hear. And as part of the program, they are invited to stay after this argument and discuss the procedures of the court with a justice. There is not a discussion of the substantive issues of the case. And everyone here is invited to join the students for that discussion. Let me introduce the court to you all now that we've met you. Starting at my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser, with whom you'll meet after this case. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. To his right, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. With these introductions made, I'll now call our second case for the day, 03-0988, Matthew Furden versus Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund. Representing Matthew Furden will be Attorney Marie Stanton for 15 minutes. Also representing Matthew Furden will be Merrick Domnitz for 10 minutes, and representing the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund et al. Will be Stephen P. Means. Then Ms. Stanton will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Stanton?
Thank you, Justices and Attorney Means, my counsel, Mr. Petricelli, thank you for allowing us to present. Your Honors, we appear on behalf of the plaintiff, Matthew Furden. Matthew Furden is a child who grew up north of Green Bay in Abrams, Wisconsin. When he was born in 1996, he suffered a birth injury, which was a permanent paralyzing and disfiguring arm injury. And as you know, a jury in Brown County in December of 2002 found Dr. Michael Brockman negligent in the causation of that injury. The jury awarded damages to Matthew Furden in excess of the statutory caps as well as economic damages. The caps were applied. His non-economic award was reduced to some $433,000. We are here because we feel that reduction was wrong. It was unconstitutional, and we are asking you to overturn 655.017, which permits the imposition of caps. Now, as I read the fund's brief...
Are you also asking us to overturn any cases?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Are you asking us to overturn some cases of this court?
I believe it may be necessary for you to do so with respect to the Guzman case, although that would depend upon the grounds in which you would find unconstitutionality. Unconstitutionality on equal protection in this particular case, which is the first of its kind in that it is not a wrongful death case, it is not a government case, it is not a statute of limitations case. It is a case in which there is a verdict. Makes it unique and separate from some of the other ones that you have considered. Excuse me, from all of the ones you have considered, although the same constitutional questions have been applied. Now, as I read the fund's brief, I should about pack up and go home right now because they've indicated that we will lose our argument for two reasons. The first is the stare decisis doctrine advising us that the case has already been decided and there's no need to return here. And secondly, because the burden of proof is very large in a constitutional question and it's one that we will not be able to meet. Well, we will stay and make our argument, and we thank you very much for accepting the petition for review to allow us to do so. The fund brief goes on to talk about the reason, and that's certainly paramount, why Chapter 655 was enacted in the first place. And in its first declaration, or one of its first, the fund notes that the Chapter 655 was attempting to strike a balance and resolve the competing interests of a series of entities. And those entities included health care providers. Those entities included lawyers. They included health insurance companies. They included liability companies, medical malpractice carriers, and the like. And that by imposing this statute, there would be a balance obtained.
If I might interrupt you for a minute, let me, when you're talking about this balancing that was struck, is it appropriate for us to look at the amount that was chosen by the jury? In other words, is it appropriate for us to determine whether the $350,000 cap that was decided upon by the legislature is a reasonable amount under all of the balancing that was going on?
I don't think it's necessary for you to do it. You may wish to do it because there will have to be some reasonable stopping point when the statute takes away that combination of jury right in connection with the remitter. Somebody is setting the amount of the verdict. And if $350,000 is comfortable, this court may say we won't do it. On the other hand, if you find unconstitutionality, you may address both the amount and the concept of setting the cap.
I'll tell you where I'm going with this, if I might continue for a minute.
Yes.
My understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding is that originally, back I think about 1986, there was a cap imposed by the legislature on non-economic damages. That cap was approximately $1 million. It had a sunset provision, and I think from about 1991 to 1995, there was no cap. In 1995, 9 years after the $1 million cap, the legislature now selects $350,000 as the cap. Now, I know they put in a adjuster clause, if you will, tied to the actions of the director of state courts and looking at consumer price indexes and that type of thing. But my concern is there something that you're arguing is at all arbitrary about going from a $1 million cap to no cap to a $350,000 cap, or is that not your argument?
My argument is that the Constitution does not permit this cap, period.
This cap or a cap of $1 million?
Does not permit this cap on this class of people.
Okay. So you have no opinion about whether the Constitution would permit a $1 million cap. I think that was the import of Justice Breyer's question.
Then let me clarify. When I meant this cap on this group of people, meaning medical malpractice victims in personal injury cases should not have their awards capped at all.
Period.
Yes.
Okay, good.
I'm sorry, as opposed to some other statute.
Okay. Thank you.
If I could ask, maybe I'm a little confused by your argument. Are you saying that no cap whatsoever or no cap that's arbitrarily set by way of a specific amount? In other words, if the legislature were to somehow come up with a rational way of capping the award based upon the economic damages that were recovered, would that be a violation of the Constitution?
In my view, it would. We do not believe this statute should be capped. We do not believe that a medical malpractice victim should have someone other than a jury quantify damages, that the court has the unique position of adjusting or assessing the fairness of the damage award. It is not the province of the legislature to do so because the basis upon which they did so no longer bears a rational relation to what exactly has happened here, as this law has evolved for 30 years.
But the import of my question was, what if the legislature could formulate a way that would rationally link it to the jury award? In other words, say a multiplier, single-digit multiplier, such as in punitive damages type cases. If the legislature were to create something of that nature, then it's kind of still related rationally to the award, is it not? the economic damages award?
The rational relationship I was looking to was the purpose of Chapter 655 in relation to the outcome. And in my view, Chapter 655 has outlived its usefulness with respect to capping personal injury awards of claimants. Juries do that.
That's why you don't, I'm not interested in fighting about the amount.
Correct.
I think that the rational basis for the statute that caps at all has disappeared.
Exactly.
Well, tell us what the rational basis was, because at one time, it's arguable that the court found there was a rational basis. Mm-hmm. That was in the 70s.
Yes.
And said, okay, Med-Mal can be separately and distinguished from other personal injury tort. Now you're saying that case, if I understand your argument, may have been good in the 70s. It's not good in 2005. Is that your position?
Yes.
If so, explain it. You bet. Please.
Well, when the subject of money first came up, it was coincident to the establishment of Chapter 655. And the first subject of money came with respect to the fund and the founding of the fund. The cap that the fund requested was $250,000. And pursuant to the water brief, you will see that the legislative session indicated that a $250,000 cap was required to keep the fund solvent. If you look in the water brief, you will see that as of 2004, the balance sheet of the fund shows a $771 million in assets. That's offset by about $730,000 or so in liabilities. But understand, the liabilities on that corporate balance sheet are not liabilities like you and I know, such as a mortgage. The liabilities are what they call unpaid losses and loss adjustment expense. They're reserves, they're projections. And furthermore, to help understand why this concept is no longer based on reality, of the $771 million in assets the fund has, $275 million are the result of investment earnings. So there is no need to have a cap to keep the fund solvent. Even in the worst of times, the fund has been apparently earning interest on its investments to the point where in June 2004, which is the balance sheet you have in the attached water brief, is $275 million.
So your argument is that the cap has presented a surplus, and therefore it is not needed. Your argument would still be the same if the contrary was true? In other words, you're saying it's unconstitutional anyway. That's your argument.
Well, that's your...
Despite the Waddle brief, other statistics, you're saying that the legislature does not have the power to invade the Constitution. In other words, we have remittiture, we have the right of jury trial. Therefore, this is just an added argument that you're making, I assume, that it's not needed because...
Well, it isn't needed, Your Honor, but when the statute was founded or established, and the duty of the court, of course, is to look not at anecdotes, but rather to look at the basis, the rational basis, the fund at one time talked about running out of money. It will never run out of money. I mean, we've all basically read the accounting reports about the fund, so I really don't look to the point, well, what if the fund wasn't doing so well? The reality is in 2005, it's doing just great.
And that's my question about the fund.
But, counsel, why does rational basis or strict scrutiny or anything come into play if you're talking about, as you did earlier, the 1-5 right to jury trial and separation of powers on the remittiture thing? I mean, it seems to me that the argument that it's not needed and may have been needed before, is a bit at odds with an argument that's saying it's unconstitutional under 1-5 and separation of powers.
I'm not sure if I'm going to answer your question directly, but there are several reasons why I believe the statute is unconstitutional. And it's been attacked on several grounds, but the one that this Court has not heard is the equal protection argument. And what I had hoped to do was to take whatever minutes I have here was to talk about the equal protection argument. I saw the jury trial remitter issues as important but secondary. I thought that the equal protection argument was obvious because there are a veritable scorecard of classes of people that have been created by Chapter 655 who are not treated equally under the law. We have the single claimants, the married claimants, we have the claimants with children, we have claimants like Matthew Ferdan who bear a greater portion of the reduction than someone else because his injuries are more serious. We have different tortfeasors. We have doctors and health care providers who get some immunity from the statute and others who get millions of dollars of immunity from the statute because of the caps. So that it was the equal protection argument in the first instance that this Court, in a case of this nature, with an injury, with a verdict, has never addressed and which needs to be addressed because basically the perceived crisis in either the quality of care or the malpractice situation at the time that this statute was imposed never developed, and it doesn't exist.
Counselor, are we to overlook what we all hear so much about is the rising costs of health care and that being due at least to some extent to doctors trying to cover themselves by ordering extensive tests and therefore driving up your health insurance and my health insurance?
Please don't. And look to Mr. Means' argument or the fund's argument. They point out at pages 77 and 78 of their appendix that the malpractice premium has gone down or stayed steady in the four-year period of 98 to 02 as an example of what a capped state can do for its health care providers. In that period of 98 to 02, obstetricians and gynecologists showed a decrease of health liability premium. Now, with respect to your question, compare that to what you and I know, that the concomitant increase in health care costs has grown. It hasn't stayed even. It hasn't fallen down. That the corresponding increase in private health care insurance premiums is enormously higher than it was from 98 to 2002. So in answer to your question, please don't overlook it, but make this connection that we put the caps in force, we passed the statute, the malpractice premiums stayed down, but those other costs in that great group of competing interests didn't hold steady, they rose. So the logic that you impose a cap and we'll all be better off did not bear out.
In regard to health care costs?
Health care costs, insurance costs, yes. And if you take that one step further, again in the Waddell brief, in the last 10 years, there have only been 8 verdicts above the cap. So that the cap wasn't needed to hold down all these million-dollar verdicts. There's been only 8 cases. And as we well know, whatever side of the aisle you're on, 80% of the cases are lost by the plaintiffs. So the health care providers are doing quite well. The insurance rates are down on liability insurance. They win most of their cases. And we just don't have very many high verdicts in Wisconsin. So why do we need a statute capping limits on people who are injured and can't get the money that the jury's awarded?
Counselor, before you get off, I have one more question that's kind of bugging me. You want to get rid of the caps, and I understand your arguments for that, but you want to keep the fund. And the fund was set up in combination with an overall scheme of how the legislature chose to deal with what they perceived to be a problem, rightly or wrongly. Isn't that a little inconsistent? I mean, you want to keep the goose that's laying the golden eggs, but you want to get rid of the caps that were put in as part of the same scheme. Can you address that for me?
You bet. And I'd like you to come back with me to 1978 and look at the very first case that significantly looked at the function of the fund and its constitutionality, which was Strykowski, and here was the issue. Back then, the fund had created panels of people to hear cases. If your claim was worth less than $10,000, you got 3 people. If your claim was worth more than $10,000, you had 5 people, a couple of citizens, 2 doctors, a lawyer, and so forth. The challenge then, when there were no caps at all, the challenge was, look, how come the claimants with the lower cases only get a few people and those with higher get five people? It's a quaint notion, isn't it? A $10,000 medical malpractice claim? Okay. And here's the answer. The court, and this is why the fund can do some good, the court in Strykowski, in supporting the capless fund, did not say, oh, what we need to do is cut down on these large claims. The court accommodated the large claim. The court said, no, people with more complex claims, with larger issues, deserve a panel of five. We will accommodate and meet those needs of the larger claimants. That is exactly the opposite of the direction that this whole matter has taken. Now we take the people most injured and level the awards to bring them down to people with less injuries.
I guess I didn't phrase my question very well. My question didn't go to that. My question went to an overall legislative scheme that to some degree you're asking us to pick apart. You're asking us to strike down the caps, but you're not asking us to get rid of the fund, right? So you still want the doctors to be covered by 655's fund, but you don't want the caps that are part of that scheme. And I guess my concern is, are we free to take apart the legislative scheme in this way?
Well, you are here if you want to call it a taking apart, because the fund's own owners have said they don't need the caps. The fund is self-sustaining with the money it has. So if the fund offers some rights or helps to doctors with respect to providing excess insurance, which is what it is, that event could stay and be a valid event without the cap. The fund and the cap are not mutually inclusive. And understand, too, when you talk about picking things apart, that's how they got put together, one by one. First we have the fund with no caps. Then we get caps, then they get bigger, et cetera, et cetera.
And then that's the legislature, that's not us. That's my concern.
But it sounds that you're trying to make the argument that the legislature did not tie them together. Sometimes they're tied, sometimes they're not tied. And over the 25, 30-year history, sometimes you have caps, sometimes you don't have caps, but you always have the fund.
Well,
is that correct?
In effect, that's what occurred. I mean, there have been additions and subtractions, and I don't think that's a marriage of multiple people that needs to stay together to address these constitutional issues. These issues can be addressed independently, and I think it's part of the fear factor of the malpractice crisis or whatever it was back in 1975 that says you can't step in here and call a spade a spade. I mean, that equal protection is so evident that people are not treated equally under the five criteria test.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Stanton. You will have 5 minutes to rebuttal. Mr. Domnitz.
Good morning, Justices. I am Eric Domnitz of Domnitz and Skemp, and I, as always, appreciate the opportunity to stand before you and argue on behalf of my client, who today, of course, is Matthew Furden. I'd like to begin by telling you that I believe that all of the issues that were engendered in Attorney Stanton's argument to the court with regard to the caps are engendered in my argument, which wants to hone in specifically on 655.015, which is that portion of the statute which indicates that should a jury award more than $100,000 in future medical expenses, the amount over $100,000 is to be paid into the fund, to be administered by the fund during the life of the plaintiff. All of the constitutional arguments that Ms. Stanton mentioned are, as I said, included in my situation here that I'm here to address, with some interesting additions which I think constitute further violations of the Article 1, Section 5 guarantee of trial by jury in the Wisconsin Constitution, as well as Article 1, Section 13, which is known as the Takings Clause. I think, given the limited amount of time that I have to address you, Justices, I would like to call to your attention a real practical problem, a real-world problem that is visited upon every single medical malpractice victim that receives an award of future medicals in excess of $100,000, and this, of course, includes Matthew Furden.
Mr. Domnitz, if I might interrupt you for just a moment, you've drawn our attention to Article 1, Section 13, the Takings Clause of the Constitution. The other side has responded to that by saying That wasn't raised below. It's not appropriate for us to consider. Do you have any response to that?
My response is that this is clearly a constitutional issue, and this is the court to which constitutional issues are to be raised and which are ultimately to be decided. Thank you, Justice. The real practical problem to which I referred is that all of you are familiar with the methodology that attends a trial of a medical malpractice verdict. Either each side calls witnesses economists who reduce future medical expenses to present value, or even in the situation where one or neither of the sides calls such experts, we read the jury instruction 1796, which tells them that future medical expenses are to be reduced to present value. Part of the methodology of reducing future damages to present value involves either expert testimony or the adoption by the jury of some reasonable rate of return. The jury instruction specifically tells them, this money that you will award today can be invested and a reasonable rate of return is to be expected. The problem with this is that when we call these expert witnesses to the stand, whether they be plaintiff or defense experts, they all assume a reasonable rate of return. Ironically, the plaintiff's experts are always seem to adopt a lower rate of return than the defense experts do. Because as you know, the defense seeks a higher discount rate, because the higher the discount rate that's applied to the future damages, the lower the amount of money the jury has to award in order to meet the plaintiff's needs. In either event, when the jury makes their award, it engenders a determination by the jury, under the right to trial by jury, of what the expenses are that are required, the life expectancy that the plaintiff has, and then some reasonable rate of return. The problem with this statute, the unconstitutional problem with this statute, is that when the money is given to the fund to administer on behalf of the plaintiff, the money doesn't realize the rate of return that is decided by the jury. It takes the issue away from the jury and guarantees, and this is perhaps the singular statement that must be embraced by this court, it guarantees that every plaintiff in a medical malpractice case in Wisconsin will have a shortfall in his future medical expenses should that plaintiff live out his or her life expectancy. On the other hand, and interestingly in that regard, if the plaintiff lives longer than his or her life expectancy, the fund's obligation to continue to pay medical expenses does not exist. When the money's gone, and the fund is off the hook.
Are you saying that there's an arbitrary number chosen by the fund, or it's whatever the fund happens to make on the money that it keeps?
I'm talking, Justice Robinsack, only about the reality of the situation. What the fund makes on this money is a matter of public record.
Right.
And it is embarrassingly low. Currently, it's around 1%.
Okay.
There isn't a jury in the state of Wisconsin, nor an expert that's ever been called by a plaintiff or a defendant who has ever stood in front of a jury and told them to reduce an award of future medical expenses for a plaintiff on the basis of a rate of return of 1%. You can't find it anywhere.
No, that's true. But, Counselor, if the plaintiff invested the award, him or herself, after the award, there's no guarantee they're going to get what the jury hoped they would get either. You don't have a guarantee either way on that.
All of the experts testify, Justice Robinsack, on the basis of what are called riskless rates of return. Okay?
They may, but you know, your experience and my experience, as both of us haven't been around a fair amount of time here.
Thank you.
We know that, you know, the rates don't always match our expectations on any of our accounts. And I don't see, I mean, if the fund is giving you what they earn, your complaint really is that they're not doing a good enough job of managing the money, not that they set up some arbitrary amount and they're only going to pay you that amount no matter how much they earn.
There's no more guarantee that the fund will continue to receive a positive rate of return than there is any plaintiff will.
Right. So that's
the issue
kind of my point.
It really doesn't address the issue. The issue is, does the Constitution in Section 1, Article 1, Section 5, allow the fund to take away from the jury the decision about how much money is going to be available to the plaintiff?
But the jury can,
Okay, they put it in, you get the present value from the jury, and they put it in everything over the indexed $100,000. And then they have to invest that. And you get the rate of return that the fund gets paid back to the person whose money it really is, correct?
You get money that you have to come with every bill. You have to come to the party
trial. I'm not, that's a separate problem that concerns me. But right now I'm just concerned with the rate of return. And wouldn't the rate of return be the same thing if you gave the money to Merrill Lynch? And they didn't earn any more than that? Wouldn't you still just get back your money in 1%?
It isn't. You have to look at the marketplace. And I admit that we're dealing to some extent in hypothetical here because nobody can predict it. But historically, the fund's rate of return has run far below any market analysis that can be occurred, it can be gathered with regard to the general market.
So your complaint is that you don't want them managing the money because they really don't have the skill to do a good job.
Right? I don't want the party that Matthew Ferdin opposed during his trial making either his investment decisions for him, nor, and interestingly enough, with regard to the due process argument, revisiting the cause issues that were litigated in the courtroom. Matthew Ferdin walked into the courtroom and litigated against the fund the reasonableness, necessity, and relationship of his medical expenses to the active malpractice. The jury decided those issues in Matthew Ferdin's favor. Now when Matthew Ferdin's parents incur a bill, they have to go back to the defendant in his lawsuit. It submit the bill, and then the defendant, by statute, is allowed to make a decision. They revisit the decision. It's an absolute due process violation because they essentially make the plaintiff revisit an issue that he litigated and won at trial. That is a usurpation of the right to have the jury be the ultimate arbiter of fact, to quote Justice Day in his dissent in the Strakowski case.
Okay.
So that's one part of the issue. The second part of the issue is this takings clause issue, where the fund, and I dealt with the shortfall issue, and so I'll move on from there. And the other issue is that should the plaintiff, for any reason, either related to the active malpractice or not, die before his or her life expectancy is realized, and therefore before the future medical fund is exhausted, the money that the jury awarded to the plaintiff escheats to the defendant in his lawsuit. I can't think of a clearer a violation of both takings and the right to trial by jury. There is no other tort, no other area in the law when any contingency, any event in a plaintiff's life results in the money that a jury awarded to that plaintiff is cheating back to the person against whom, the entity against whom he litigated his case.
Well, the point is that the statute, the legislature in its wisdom, or you don't think it may have been wise, has decided that as to economic damages, this is economic damages, right?
These are, yes.
Not only is it going to cap non-economic damages, but as to economic damages, it really is putting a cap. The first cap is $100,000, right? And then it says, hey, it's not really your dough. It's conditional.
We'll rent it to you.
Well, we'll give it to you on your proving various items. And to the extent you use your fund, your own particular account, it's gone, right? They take 5 years, and they take, and should you die, it's also gone. So it's not really yours. It's a cap of $100,000 on non-economic, that's future damages, is what the real cap is. And then the second cap is that which the jury awarded you, subject to your losing it.
Not only is that an absolutely correct analysis, Justice Abramson, but in addition to that, you have to remember that every element of future damages in a medical malpractice case, loss of earning capacity, future pain, suffering, and disability, is all premised upon the same component parts. What does the jury determine the plaintiff's life expectancy to be? If a plaintiff dies before that life expectancy, his estate retains the future pain, suffering, and disability. the future loss of earning capacity, but for some reason that defies all rational analysis, the future medical expenses go back to the defendant. They've been rented to the plaintiff. If the plaintiff can now prevail on the same issues he prevailed at a trial and go back to the defendant and say, I would like to have this money, it's reasonable, necessary, and related to the act of malpractice. The only component of damages on the whole verdict to which that analysis applies.
Okay. Any other questions of Mr. Domitz? Hearing none, thank you, Mr. Domitz. Mr. Means, representing the Compensation Fund.
Thank you. May I please report? My name is Steve Means. With me at council table is Chris Mansour, Roisin Bell. We represent the Injured Patients and Families Compensation Fund. After a couple opening remarks, I'm going to address the issues that have been raised in this case. First, stare decisis. Second, the constitutionality of the damages cap. And third, the account on future medical expenses. One thing that was alluded to in questions but has not been acknowledged by the counsel for the plaintiffs is that, in fact, the cap on damages in the future medical account are part of a comprehensive legislative scheme that was enacted to deal with medical malpractice claims. This is not a standalone damage cap that can be evaluated apart from the other parts of that system. The system adopted in Wisconsin is literally unlike any system in the nation. Particularly, no system in the nation ensures a guaranteed recovery of economic damages for an injured plaintiff. In this case, we've heard about Matthew Ferdin. Matthew Ferdin, when he was injured, at the time was too young in his own mind to think about the long-term consequences. But certainly, the first thought in the mind of his parents were, how is Matthew going to care for himself when he's older? How is Matthew going to support himself and a family if he can't work? How is Matthew going to pay for medical care? Under the system adopted by the legislature of the state of Wisconsin, those costs are covered. If a jury determines that he needs medical care, that's covered by an unlimited cap. You don't have to worry by an unlimited patient compensation fund. You don't have to worry about an uninsured doctor. You don't have to worry about a doctor who has $500,000 in liability insurance. Because through Chapter 655, the fund is available to cover any and all economic damages. And so you're not looking at status quo plus a damage cap. You're looking at a system that, in fact, attempts to balance the interests of all parties involved in these disputes and, in fact, does balance that interest.
What about the argument that opposing counsel made that with the assets in the fund, it's never going to run out, and therefore what was perhaps perceived as good, sound legislation several years ago is no longer needed? And I'm just going to skip the constitutional argument. You're getting to that. But just that was maybe a throw-in, but that the fund itself will never run out.
And, Your Honor, I find that an interesting argument. The record that was brought on appeal, this issue wasn't tried at the circuit court level, obviously, but the information, if you accept it as true, says that this, quote, surplus is 3% of the fund assets. Now, anybody who's involved with insurance law knows that if a commercial insurance carrier had reserved claims of $700-something million and had 3%, quote, surplus, the commissioner of insurance would be knocking on their door, shutting them down and taking them over because they don't have enough money.
Counselor, is this the same surplus that the governor and the legislature are talking about taking $310 million out of to balance our budget?
That's exactly right. And, you know, that's another issue. That's an issue that the fund has stated its position on in the past. But certainly, you know, if that money is fair game for the legislature, it's not there. Given the fact that we're in 2005, which is not that too long after a period in when investments, instead of going up, even at 1%, went down very low. To argue that this fund is good enough forever, you never have to do anything with it, that's completely speculative, and I don't think it takes account into the facts of what has actually happened.
Mr. Means, since we're talking about money, $300 million maybe being taken, that brings me to something that you could probably tell from my earlier questions concerns me, and that has to do with the amount of the cap. As I understand the history, and again, I invite you to correct me if I'm wrong, we went from a $1 million cap on non-economic damages in 1986 to no cap from 91 to 95, and then a $350,000 cap. That strikes me, and tell me why I'm wrong on this, that strikes me as somewhat arbitrary by the legislature, even though they built in an escalator clause on that $350,000. Tell me where I'm going wrong, because I sense that this is arbitrary.
Sure. I think there's probably three ways to answer that question. The first is the cap at issue here is the $350,000 cap. And the reason that's not arbitrary, among other reasons, is because at the time the legislature was presented with information which showed that a $250,000 cap was needed to keep the fund solvent. Okay, so
that deals with the fund.
Excuse me?
That deals with keeping the fund solvent. How does that relate to the jury verdict?
Well, that's a legitimate public purpose that the legislature has. When the legislature creates a fund to compensate victims, they certainly have a legitimate purpose in keeping that fund solvent.
But that's just part of the equation. You still have to relate the jury award to the cap. I don't see how you can divorce one from the other. Otherwise, you're having a legislative decision of the jury award. That doesn't make sense.
Yes, and I would like to address that question. If I might finish, Justice Crooks, then I'll come back to that.
Go ahead.
The second issue is, what we have is a system where the legislature had a cap, there was no cap, the legislature saw what that was like, and they decided they needed a cap. So in terms of there being a rational legislative judgment, that interim period without a cap confirms the judgment that they made.
Well, now, if $250,000 was going to keep the fund solvent, why not return to the 86 cap of $1 million and be sure it was solidly solvent?
Well, and that gets to the third part of my answer.
Okay.
And for this part of the answer, as I did with the brief, I turned to minds that were much better than mine. To answer your questions, I'd like to turn to Justice Abramson. And this was addressed by her in the Sams case, which is a case that involved caps that were applied to claims against municipalities. And she quotes from an earlier decision, Stanhope. And quoting that case, Chief Justice said, the court recognized that whatever the monetary limitation on recovery, the amount will seem arbitrary because it's based on imponderables and that the legislature, not the court, must select the figure. The limit enacted by the legislature must be accepted unless we can say that it is very wide of any reasonable mark.
That's an answer to Justice Butler.
And the answer
wide of a reasonable mark.
Yes. I'm sorry, could you state that again?
As I remember, having written Sams, that there's a kicker in it, or sometimes some people say wiggle room, and that is that the amount that is set by the legislature is reviewable by this court, and that it has to be within a reasonable mark. And I think at that time that well, it may have been for municipality, it may have been $25,000, which was then substantially increased because it became quite obvious that was or would soon not be a reasonable mark. And that's Justice Butler's question to you, that doesn't it have to be reasonable in relation to the damages suffered?
Yeah. And in response to that,
That was, of course, a government defendant, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And FISC and government immunity in broad terms.
Yes.
You think that applies here?
Well, I think that applies for two reasons. One is the point, as I understood your opinion, was that any amount you pick is going to be subject to question because when you have a range, $25,000 may not make any more sense than 20 or 50. I think the other point was that you know, in that case, certainly I think the Court recognized, and certain justices have recognized at other times, that there is a point at which a limit may be such that it is so low that it can't withstand, that it can't be upheld. Now, different limits that have been approached, and that's not necessarily a jury issue, because that's the same issue that you have, whether it's a municipal cap or a cap in a case that would be a jury trial. You know, the issue there is it rational? Does it make sense?
Mr. Means, I can clarify my question. But assume for purposes of the question that the concept of caps would be considered legitimate by this Court. My question goes to how you determine the cap. Can you just pick a number out of the air, or does it have to rationally relate to what the jury determines in an individual case?
You know, the legislature obviously does not have the ability to take testimony from Matthew Ferdin and his doctors or the other malpractice plaintiffs.
What about a multiplier based on economic damages? A percentage?
Yeah, and I haven't considered that issue. I think all of these things fall into the area of the legislature adopting public policy. And this Court has said that the legislature needs to have a very broad scope within which it can act, that it's equipped to make those type of judgments. Again, the legislature has the ability to, you know, gather studies of the type that have been submitted by the plaintiffs and to commission their own studies and to interview.
How can the legislature determine what is appropriate for Matthew Ferdin's situation?
And my response is that was not what the legislature undertook to do. The legislature did not undertake to say what's going to be full compensation for absolutely everyone. The legislature undertook to balance competing interests and to make a limit on what the legal amount of recovery would be required. It's very similar to what has been done in many other situations where the legislature has stepped in between what a jury finds as the facts and what the Court enters as a judgment. And in many different situations, the legislature has acted to take what starts here and change it before it ends up in the judgment of the Court. And if
you would, could you link your argument, given that answer, to Mr. Ferdin's constitutional right to trial by jury? I want to deal specifically with that issue.
Yes. And certainly, Matthew Ferdin had a right to a trial by jury. That's preserved in the Constitution. And he had a trial by jury. A jury heard the evidence. They decided who to believe. They heard the witnesses on liability. They heard the witnesses on damages. And they made a factual determination. In Wisconsin, that's the role of the jury. Now, and that's been established by a number of cases that we've cited in our brief, that the jury finds facts. It's not their role to decide what happens with those facts. And in many cases, a court is actually prohibited from telling a jury what's going to happen with the facts that it finds. It's never been the case that once a jury finds the fact, that a court is stuck with the facts. In many cases, the legislature steps in and makes a determination on public policy reasons as to what's going to happen with the facts as found by the jury. A classic example is comparative negligence. At common law, if a defendant was negligent and damages were $100,000 as determined by the jury, then that moved pretty quickly into the judgment of the court. But then the legislature stepped in and said, for public policy reasons, we don't want that to happen. Now, it's important to remember that the right to a jury trial is not just a plaintiff's right. It's a defendant's right as well. And a defendant had the right at common law that if there was negligence found with the plaintiff in any degree, then he walked away free. But the legislature said, no, we don't like that result. There's other situations. The Safe Place Act. At common law, a jury would decide what's reasonable, and if they thought something wasn't reasonable, then that ended up being part of the judgment of the court. But the legislature stepped in and said, no, that's not good enough, because when people go into a place of business, we want them to be safe. And it set a higher standard. And so you have many, many situations where in cases where there was a right to a jury at common law, where the jury says one thing, it's processed through a determination of public policy by the legislature, and the court enters the judgment. And in fact, that's a right that was expressly reserved to the legislature in the Constitution. Article 14, Section 13 says that the legislature has a right to alter or modify the common law.
But Article 14, Section 13 does not give the legislature the right to modify or change other constitutional rights, merely the common law, right?
Certainly at some point, that authority has to be exercised in some way that it does not infringe on constitutional rights. And that goes back, again, to the function that a jury performed. Now, in some of the other states that have enacted damage caps, they go through a whole historical analysis of what juries did, what they didn't do at common law. In our case, we don't have to go back that far because the Supreme Court has said on a number of occasions what it is that juries do in Wisconsin. We cited the Del Valle opinion in our brief, which, if I can find it, we cited that in our brief, which is also similar to the McGowan case, which has to do with comparative negligence. And in the Del Valle case, this court said, the jury is a finder of fact. Its charge does not include the applying the relevant law to the facts of the case, which is the function of the court. Indeed, the law applicable to a given set of facts is irrelevant to the function of finding those facts. Going on, it is the duty of the jury to find the facts and the duty and the domain of the court to determine the legal rights of the parties after return of the verdict. And in this case, the jury found the facts. The jury found that Matthew Ferdin had suffered or would suffer non-economic damages in a certain amount. Now, the legislature said, okay, but that's not necessarily going to determine what the judgment's going to be. And that is something that the legislature has done many, many times. The Unfair Sales Act, which was the subject of a recent decision by this court in Village Food and Liquor Mart, says that a claim under the Unfair Sales Act is a claim where there's a right to jury trial because that claim existed in 1848. And so even though it's a statutory claim, it has to be heard by a jury. But another part of that statute says that if you violate the Unfair Sales Act, you're going to pay $2,000 a day in damage regardless of what damages the defendant suffered. Now, again, at common law, the jury says the defendant cheated me and the damages were $5. At common law, that resulted in a judgment of $5. Today, the legislature says, no, for public policy reasons, we're going to change the compensation. And the compensation is not going to be $5, it's going to be $2,000. And there's many, many enactments like that where the legislature, for public policy reasons, has decided what's going to happen with the facts as the jury finds them. And again, no one has kept the jury from finding the facts. They did find the facts.
You do agree, though, that the legislature has to have a rational basis for what it does.
Absolutely. And I think in this case...
You do agree that this court reviews that.
This court reviews under the due process for arbitrary or capriciousness.
And equal protection.
And equal protection, that's correct.
But you have to have a rational basis. What's the rational basis here?
Before I answer that, and I will, it's important to note that in determining the rational basis, that it's this court's obligation to start with the presumption that a statute's valid. And it's the challenger's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it's not. When the court begins the process, excuse me?
I accept that.
Okay. When the court begins the process of looking for the rational basis, it looks at what the legislature said. And if it's satisfied with that, fine. If it's not satisfied with that, then the court has to look for a rational basis that would have supported the legislature's determination had it done that. In this case, I think there's a number of things that satisfy what the rational basis was.
I have a question about that.
Yes.
Do you look as of the date of the enactment of this bill, which has been amended over the years, or do you look at it, the rational basis today?
Yeah, I think initially you look at what happened when the bill was enacted. I think at some point in time, it may get to the point where a piece of legislation is so far removed that a court says, well, what made sense, you know, 20 years ago or 100 years ago doesn't make sense today.
Okay.
I don't think we're at that point here. The reason for this legislation is well documented and it's been recognized by this court many times, and that is the legislature of the state of Wisconsin is concerned about making health care both accessible and affordable for the people of this state. The state of Wisconsin is also concerned about rising costs of liability insurance. Now, we heard argument earlier that, you know, we don't need to worry about that because rates are going down. And I've got to believe that counsel and the court understand the fallacy in that argument. And the fallacy in that argument is the point is not are rates higher today than what they were yesterday. The important question is what are rates today as compared to what they would be if the legislature hadn't addressed this situation. And
both to stand in front of the microphone because you're being recorded.
Okay. So I think to just look at, you know, different categories of premiums, have they gone up or down, I think that misses the point. We do have, in information that has been submitted by the plaintiffs, study after study, which acknowledges that there is a crisis. And that's a word that I didn't choose. It's a word they chose in their studies. Now, I don't think it matters if you consider there to be a crisis or not. But the point is, it's uniformly agreed that there's a problem with rising costs of liability insurance for physicians and hospitals. I think sometimes we think of this as being a physician issue. It's not. Hospitals, ambulatory surgery centers, some nursing homes are covered by Chapter 655. But it's clear that that's an issue. It's also clear that in states that have enacted caps, that they have had slower rates of growth in premiums than states that have not enacted caps. And that's not disputed.
Slower rates of what?
Of premium increases.
Well, what about, you know, premium increases are fine.
Yes.
We're looking at what's accessible and affordable to meet the patient.
Yes.
So I want to know, is health care accessible in Wisconsin? I keep reading that hundreds of thousands of people don't have health care insurance, aren't able to get health care insurance, can't afford health care insurance, and are without health care insurance, and therefore are at the mercy of charity or some government programs which keep getting reduced. So if the goal is accessible and affordable, are we near that goal?
And I think that question raises another fallacy that was presented by the plaintiff's arguments, and that is if you can go to rural Wisconsin and you can't find a doctor, then it means that accessibility is not being addressed. And that's not true. Again, what you look at is not what things are like today. You look at what things are like today as compared to what they might be if Wisconsin had not taken steps to address these issues.
We have more or less doctors in rural areas now.
I don't know. I don't know that anyone has – I don't know if that's part of the record. I do know that there's a need for health care providers in different areas. I know that the doctors are telling us that they don't want to go into states where there aren't caps. And, you know, I know that the legislature has made the judgment that if they can address liability in a way that provides people like Matthew Ferdin everything they're going to need to care for themselves in the future – that a trade-off may be appropriate.
How can that be when after this amount is used up, Mr. Ferdin gets no more?
Well, again, that goes to what the jury determined. If the jury was wrong, I don't think there's anything that the Patient Compensation Fund can do about that. But what the Patient Compensation Fund has done through Chapter 655 has said, okay, juries, we're going to accept what you tell us. We're going to accept that there's this much in future medical damages, and we're going to make sure it's there for you. Now,
so this is a protection of the victim.
I think that's certainly a part of what is intended, and I think that was recognized by the court in Strakowski. That's certainly a function of this. I think there's other reasons for it. But certainly I think there's some interest in keeping these expenses available for the person who suffered the injury.
Counsel, I want to turn your attention a little bit to the arguments made by opposing counsel in regard to 655.015. And the argument on the takings clause, I understand from your brief it wasn't raised, but I still want to talk about it anyway, as you probably guessed would be the case. And my concern is this. He has represented to us that when someone has incurred health care costs after the jury verdict at a time when the fund has his money, that he again has to justify those expenses as being medically necessary. And so, therefore, you've really taken the money from him. You're not just safekeeping it for him, but you've really taken it away. Can you address that, please?
Yes. First of all, I disagree with the characterization. Second of all, I think one thing that you're asking goes to whether or not that was a good idea for the legislature. I'm not sure it rises to a constitutional issue. But to go to the substance of it, this is not a trial. It's not an adversary proceeding. It doesn't duplicate anything that the jury did. A jury in 1999 may decide that between now and 2025, this person's going to need $500,000 worth of medical care. But the jury doesn't get an invoice from the year 2010 and decide that this care relates to the injury. That's a different process. And it's not that different from the process that many of us go through when we submit receipts for medical care for reimbursement under, you know, different accounts. The suggestion that because the fund was a defendant that they're going to vindictively withhold reimbursement for valid expenses, you know, certainly there's no record on that, and certainly it doesn't make sense. I don't think there's any interest that's established by the record. I don't think there's any interest that makes sense that would justify a fear that the patient's compensation fund is going to hold on to Matthew Ferdin's money and keep him from getting health care.
Mr. Means, if I could follow up Justice Rogensack's question, I'm comparing two clauses here. The last sentence in 655.015, the payments shall be made under the system until either the account is exhausted or the patient dies. Then I turn to page 119 of the plaintiff's appendix, dealing with the Wisconsin Administrative Code, Chapter Insurance 17, on healthcare liability insurance payments, liability insurance patients compensation fund. And under paragraph 4F, if an injured person dies and there's a balance in his or her account, the balance shall revert to the insurer or other person responsible for establishing the account. Now, since the jury has already awarded the money to the plaintiff, and since I don't see anything in the statute that says the money reverts, why doesn't that money go back or to the plaintiff's estate? And if it should or shouldn't, is this particular provision of the administrative code consistent with the statute? Does it properly interpret the statute?
Well, to be honest, I did not go back to try to look for an argument that, in fact, the money didn't go to the fund. When someone's saying money goes to my client, I assume they're right. I think as to whether or not it's a valid, let's assume that that is what the regulation does. That's a completely different issue than whether or not the statute is constitutional. If there's an argument that the administrative rule is inconsistent with the statute, let the argument be made. It certainly wasn't made at the trial court level in this case. I would like to address what I think has been mentioned here, which is this idea of a windfall. And again, you know, I just disagree with that characterization, and let me tell you why. A jury can do what a jury can do, and that is a jury can make predictions based upon the best information that they have available to them. And if a jury thinks that Matthew Ferdin is going to live for 50 years, they make a judgment on that basis, and the amount reflects it. If, in fact, Matthew Ferdin only lives 25 years, then this award of damage covers something that never happened. And when you say there's a windfall for the fund to get that money back, what I say is the prediction of damages was wrong, and the defendant that had to pay those damages gets the money back because the jury for one reason or another, not because of anything they did wrong, didn't have the numbers right.
Then why doesn't the converse hold true, that if the defendant lives in excess of the 50 years, the fund should continue to pay?
And if the legislature had done that, I think that would be a constitutional enactment.
It's a one-way street, the way it works now. Just a one-way street. And what is the rational basis for that?
Your Honor, I would disagree with the characterization that it's a one-way street, and I would disagree with any characterization that Chapter 655 is an anti-plaintiff provision. I think that Wisconsin has done a good job of addressing all of the competing interests, and I think Wisconsin, as shown by all studies that have been done that show that Wisconsin is in a better place than other states in the nation, I think it shows that the legislature did do a good job. With respect to this particular...
Is there any constitutional impediment for the legislature to say, regardless of what the jury awards, there will be no money paid for non-economic damages?
Are you talking about the workers' compensation example? Okay, that's a situation where the legislature has done just that, and the courts have found that to be constitutional.
Is there any impediment at all in the Constitution, or would it change your constitutional arguments if the cap here were at $75,000?
And again, I think that gets back into the issue of the amount. And I think this
quite obviously.
Yes, and I think this court.
Is there any change in your constitutional arguments if the cap were $75,000?
Well, you know, obviously as the amount gets smaller, I think that there may be more reason to try and construct a rationale. I think this court has been very clear on a couple of points. One is that caps per se aren't a problem.
What constitutional argument of yours would change, and in what way, if the cap here was $75,000?
To make the constitutional argument in that situation, I'd have to look at why the legislature chose that number. I'd have to, if I didn't find their actual reasons sufficient and I were the court, I'd have to construct a reason. And I'd have to try and replicate why that judgment was made.
Is it only an equal protection question that your analysis or argument might change? Is there any other constitutional claim here where your argument would change if the cap was $75,000?
I apologize. I'm having a little trouble understanding the question. I guess
does it affect your right to a jury trial? If the jury awards you $750,000 and $75,000 is what the cap is, does that implicate at all the right to a jury trial?
Yeah, I don't know.
And does it implicate at all the right to separation of powers?
I think in each case, again, you would have to look at the legislation. In workers' compensation, it was constitutional to take away all non-economic damages.
The part of the, not all, part of the disability, permanent total disability benefit incorporates the pain and suffering. If you go back and look at some of the history, would support that it is a quantifiable amount. It's a definite amount, but permanent disability payments incorporate a predetermined amount for pain and suffering. So to say that it does away with pain and suffering, I think, is incorrect.
Yeah. Well, and again, my purpose was not to be specific on workers' compensation, but to use that as an example where the court doesn't consider a jury determination of pain and suffering, but instead makes a statutory determination of compensation. And I think that Chapter 655, as has been recognized by this court in many situations, is very comparable to the workers' compensation scheme. Certainly, it's not as drastic a replacement, but by the same token, you have common law claims that had been replaced by statutory claims, particularly where the patient compensation fund is involved.
Retaining
that the plaintiff has the burden of proof of negligence and bears the cost of such a proof, whereas in workers' comp, the plaintiff does not have to show negligence, and the costs of proving up workers' compensation are much less. So there was, as the literature says, quid pro quo, and there isn't a quid pro quo here. What does the victim get?
And again,
gets a right to a jury trial and gets limited damages.
The victim gets a patient compensation fund that promises to cover all economic damages. Again, I don't think that's a small thing, particularly if I'm Matthew Ferdin's parents, thinking about how he's going to care for himself.
Which the patient doesn't get because only gets $100,000, and if he dies, he doesn't get anything.
And again, I disagree that there's something sinister in the fund where people are trying to deny him proper reimbursement.
It doesn't have to be sinister. It's a fact, though.
Mr. Means, if you were to lose this case on constitutional grounds, are there any other statutes that would be affected, in your opinion?
I believe there would be. I believe there would be any number of statutes that could be affected. Certainly, I think comparative negligence would be at issue. I think any statute that, again, depending upon the grounds that are used, any statute that sets a multiple damages amount, I think would be at risk. I think statutes which determine the amount of liability that can be assessed, or the amount of fault that can be assessed in a certain situation. For example, you have seatbelt laws. You have laws that say what a jury can do when someone doesn't wear a helmet on a motorcycle. You have strict liability statutes. It used to be a jury would decide if there was negligence, if someone got bit by a dog. The legislature says no. All you have to prove now is that the person owned the dog. You have statutes where people are held liable for costs of environmental cleanups, where at common law, maybe they wouldn't be held liable unless they had done something to cause the contamination. And I believe there would be any number of statutes that would be subject to having to be reviewed if the court decides that the path between what a jury finds as facts has to be unimpeded by the time it gets to what the court enters as a judgment. That's never been the law of Wisconsin. And I think if the court decides to reverse the Court of Appeals, the Circuit Court, overrule Guzman, overrule Strykowski, and overrule the Marin case, then I think there certainly will be other statutes that have to be looked at.
A number of years ago, there was a statute imposing a cap on malpractice for people at University Hospital. Is that still around?
There are statutory caps that govern state employees. There are caps which govern public hospitals.
And so the same kind of acts of malpractice would have a different cap, a lower cap?
That's correct.
Would those fall too, in your opinion?
Again, I think it depends on the rationale. I think an argument would be made that those situations are more like the statute in SAMS, which dealt with public employers, and because there was immunity at common law, that the legislature has more discretion to limit in those cases. I think the equal protection arguments would be the same. I think the due process arguments would be the same. And an argument we've tried to make in our brief is it's to decide this case, you not only have to decide this case against my client, the court would not only have to disagree with Guzman and Strykowski and the majority in Morin, this court would also have to disagree with the standards under which those cases were decided. The standards of review when a piece of legislation is reviewed for constitutionality.
Thank you, counsel.
I suspect my time has been up for quite a while, so thank you.
Ms. Stanton, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. What about the house of cards coming down on all liability statutes? Limited liability, comparative negligence.
I guess I have more confidence, Your Honor.
You'll have to stand in front of the microphone.
My apologies. I guess I have more confidence in the court and in the legislature, but primarily the court, that one decision will not create a house of cards, that everything will not fall. We have been selective over the decades, sometimes to our detriment, but other times we have been selective out of necessity, and there's been slow buildings and slow taking downs, and sometimes they've been rapid. But I don't think that fear factor is important here. You know, one of the things that I want to return to Justice Crooks, who asked about is that cap arbitrary? It's bounced all over. It's been 350. It's been a million. Sometimes it isn't there. And Mr. Means says, you know, those malpractice premiums, they're low now, but that's what we have to compare. Malpractice premiums low versus what they would be if we had no cap. We had no cap. We had no cap from 1991 to 1995 or 6, and we're all here. And the fund did terrific. Their investments soared. So we do not have to sit in this uncertain zone of worrying about what will happen because you have 4 years of experience of Wisconsin without a cap.
Isn't that a legislative determination on what to do with that 4 years? Are we supposed to go back and say, well, legislature, you couldn't do this because you didn't need a cap for those years, so now you can't have a cap, period?
How I would use the 4 years, Justice Rogan-Sack, is to serve as the rational basis for overturning this statute on constitutional grounds, because the 4 years shows you the cap is unnecessary. That's not something for the legislature to determine. You can all take notice of that. The records of the fund are public.
Right, but there was more involved in setting a cap than whether the fund was solvent. It was the premiums for medical malpractice, if I understand the argument. What are we to do with that? To say that wasn't a reasonable reason for having a cap?
So that it would assist in keeping the premiums down?
Yes, yes.
If you review some of the materials, you will see that even the Medical Protective Company, which is a defendant in this suit, and studies attached to the Waddle records will show you that the whole cost of the whole medical malpractice system in Wisconsin is less than 1% of the health care costs. So, yes, you can look at those premiums, but it's a small matter. It is so overblown, it is a small matter, and there is plenty of data to support that.
Ms. Stanton, Mr. Means brought Morin up at the tail end of his argument. I would have asked him, but his red light had been on for a while, so I'll ask you. What, if any, is the applicability of Morin to the facts of this case?
Well, of course, Morin took on two issues, and that's whether or not the cap would apply singly for two people and how that would be decided, and secondarily, the cap in a wrongful death case. And what I can tell you simply is from my reading of Morin, and obviously that's your decision, it seemed a great deal of time and effort was put into the concept of wrongful death and how we deal with that as a damage item that's built on a relationship of a person not with us, as opposed to an injured plaintiff who is there, present, and presenting in front of the jury.
So wrongful death is a creature of statute, is that correct?
It is a creature of statute, not of common law. It was created by the legislature. It can come and it can go. The right of an injured to recover and be compensated is quite different. Okay. I wanted to...
But the Morin case did rely fairly heavily on the Guzman case, did it not?
Right. And in the Guzman case, Justice Prosser, number one, there was no verdict in that case. That went up on concepts. There was never a verdict in the case. And on the Guzman case, of course, that, as I'm trying to recall, it was an injury case, but it was not a verdict case, and it was not your case. The Guzman case, as I recall, was one justice or judge writing the majority decision, a second concurring judge who concurred reluctantly and who said he'd rather go the other way, and one dissenting justice. So, judge. So as you look at the Guzman case and we read the three opinions, it was hardly an endorsement, hardly an endorsement. The counsel commented, and just a couple of quick comments in rebuttal. Number one, he commented about this business on the fund and having to apply to get your money back. The Wisconsin Administrative Code is 17.26. I'm reading from it. Mr. Domnitz accurately reported that to you. The Administrative Code 17.26, paren 4, paren C, provides upon receipt of the claimant's request for reimbursement of medical expenses the fund after determining that the supplies or services provided were necessary and incidental to the injury sustained, and that they've actually been paid, will then indeed pay the claim. So that this isn't make-believe. We are reapplying for injuries that have already been compensated and an award has been rendered. And I see my time is out, so.
Thank you, Ms. Stanton.
Well, thank you, and thank you all very much.
That concludes yet another argument relating to CAPS and the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund. I want to thank all the attorneys who have argued, Ms. Stanton, Mr. Domnitz, Mr. Means, for their arguments today. That concludes our hearing in 03-0988. And the court is in recess until 1:30. The students who wish and others who wish to remain to hear Justice Prosser discuss procedures may do so, and there will be additional students coming in. We are in recess for 1:30.